Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. What a wild and wonderful week it's been. I've been busy, 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 busy. So I apologize for this podcast coming out just a little bit later than it used to. I've been in beautiful Chicago for the GoTo conference. There were customer meetings and meetups, of course. And I also had the unique opportunity to visit, for the very first time, the beautiful city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was, as I say, the very first time I'd ever been there. And it was amazing. What a crazy, cool little city. I listened to this American history podcast called The Dollop. And it's hilarious. It's really funny. It's belly laugh inducingly funny. I love that podcast. It's a podcast that looks at funny stories in history. Usually, of course, American history. But history nonetheless. And it's narrated by a comedian, Dave Anthony, and his comedian friend, Gareth Reynolds. Gareth is Welsh, but he was raised in Milwaukee. And he's on Twitter. And even though I look up to him and he's, very famous, but I just sent a message out there saying, hey, can you recommend things that I might go look at or do or whatever when I visit your fair city? And lo, to my surprise and gratitude, he responded, which is super cool, right? That's really great. And so I asked what he'd recommend a visitor do in his fair city, and he gave me a few things. He said, go try Cousins Sub sandwiches, get a Spotted Cow beer, check out Cops Frozen Custard, and somebody else had suggested I try the Curtis cheese balls. So I did all that. Actually, I didn't do that. My colleague Catherine and I did that, right? We had some business to take care of ahead of my meetup that evening in the city. But before that, after the business, but before the meetup, we took care of all this. We actually went out and took a drive around the city. It was amazing. People were friendly. The food was good. It was just a really nice experience. So I really had a lot of fun. And the people that we met with and the people we engaged with at the meetups and at these customers were amazing as well. So truly, really interesting place. I like to think I travel to some pretty interesting places, but I'll definitely want to come back to Milwaukee as well. That was great. So, I've just gotten back from Chicago, where, of course, I was there for GoTo and all these other things as well. It was pouring sideways, both in Chicago and Milwaukee. So I'm now ever so briefly back in San Francisco. And in a day, I'll fly off to Sao Paulo for QCon. So, you know how it is, always on the road. But because it's been kind of busy, like I say, this podcast is a little bit late. Sorry about that. But it's going to be worth it. Don't worry, I promise. Today, we have a very special guest, a engineer who joined the Spring Cloud team fairly recently. Olga is, even though she's a fairly new member of the team, she's already an outsized contributor of epic awesomeness and code. She's an engineer, as I say, on Spring Cloud. And I think it's fair to say that even though she works on a little bit of everything, she has a focus on Spring Cloud Contract, or at least so far that's been a large part of what she's done, and what she did before she even officially joined us. So she's just really been, a pivotal part of the team for a long time, and it's just really great to have her on the team. And I loved having the opportunity to sit down with her in Cape Town, South Africa, a few weeks ago, and to have this roving and interesting discussion about her experiences in testing and in coming to the Spring team and about Spring Cloud Contract and so much more. And she was super indulgent. That's the other thing. She's a busy engineer, right? She's a senior engineer and she's got all sorts of things to do. And earlier that day, she'd taken some time to show me to help me figure out some things, right? I was trying to figure out some things this Spring. And of course, she was, more generous than I deserve, certainly. And then, without any notice, really, I asked her if she'd be willing to record an episode of the podcast. And, just a few short hours later, we were recording this interview. So I really want to thank Olga. She was a super interesting guest. I learned tons, and I expect that you will learn tons as well. We're started. Hi.
Hello.
to everybody listening, I'm joined today by my friend Olga. Can you introduce yourself and also help me pronounce your last name?
Okay, so it's Olga Maciaszek Sharma. Usually the last part of my surname is the easiest to pronounce because Sharma, yeah, most of English speakers can pronounce Sharma, while Maciaszek is sort of difficult.
It's a bit more difficult for me, yeah.
Yeah.
But so Olga, so you and I are in Johannesburg, South Africa for the Spring One Tour event here for 2019. And we've just been hanging out with the Spring community today, right? And they are happy to see you because you work on the Spring team, of course. What do you do?
I work with the Spring Cloud team. Mm-hmm. So I mostly work on Spring Cloud contract, but I also contribute and fix bugs in some other Spring Cloud projects like Spring Cloud Netflix, Spring Cloud Gateway, Spring Cloud OpenFane. So I try to do bits and pieces in various projects of the framework, but the major changes I've so far done mostly in contract. Mm-hmm. Because that's the project I have contributed to before I even joined Spring, before that project has joined Spring, and just since it was created. And that's probably how I got started with contributing and working on the Spring Cloud stack.
Okay. So before we get too much into that, do other people on the team have trouble pronouncing your name? Is it just me?
No, I think it's most of the people other than my colleagues from Poland.
Right.
So there's Marcin Grzejszczak.
And by the way, we've got him.
Yeah.
And Jakub.
Jakub Pilimon, yeah, right. They definitely can pronounce my name.
Right.
And for the others, I guess it's still a bit of a challenge.
Marcin, he at least he's very funny about it. We did a presentation together in Poland, right? And we knew that I would sound like an idiot, you know, more than usual, right? Because I sound like an idiot most of the time, but we did this presentation together.
That's not true.
Oh, it's pretty true. And we did this presentation together in Poland a few years ago. I don't know, 2016
or 17. I think I remember that.
Oh, and in my presentations, a lot of times I ask the audience for names, right?
Uh-huh.
And so,
was
of course,
it a GeekCon?
DevOps, maybe?
DevOps.
I don't
know. One of these presentations.
Yeah, so I'm asking for names to put in this presentation, you know, to demo, right? And of course, we're in Poland, so yeah. Everybody's name scares me, you know, because I don't know how to, you know, my eyes tear up, you know, I just don't know what I'm hearing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, don't worry, we'll just use some very simple names that, you know, that everybody here will know how to spell. Don't worry, just use my name. Go ahead. Go ahead, Marcin Grzejszczak, you know, go ahead. Just use my name. Go ahead. And of course, the whole audience, they laughed because they know, you know.
Yeah, it's impossible.
It's impossible for me. I have no idea.
And I think it's even more impossible for you to figure out the spelling
right.
From the sound of it.
Well, I mean, for you, you could do it, right? I know it's possible.
Obviously, that's my mother tongue, but.
But for me, I've got family kind of in Poland, you know.
Oh, do you?
Kind of. My mother in the 1990s, right? My mother played bridge online. Online, right? She's been playing video games basically since the 90s with a woman named Roma, right? She played for a long time, and Roma at the time lived in the Netherlands with her husband, but she's Polish. And Roma, just this amazing, amazing woman. And when I was a young man, I went to the Netherlands, like back in 2000 and 2000 something. I went there, and my partner at the time, my girlfriend at the time, we stayed with Roma. We brought her gifts from my mother, and we stayed with her and met her. And, you know, great, you know, lovely person. And every now and then we keep in contact. And then as I started traveling more to Poland, you know, I'd go see her. And of course, she moved back to to Poland, right? After many years later, she moved back to Poland. So I'd go visit her now in Poland. And her name was Roma, but she lived in a city called Łódź. You and I know what Łódź is, but if you look at the spelling, to a Westerner, it looks like an L O D Z,
Yes.
Something like that. I pronounce it Lodz or something like that. It's not even close, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So in Polish, it's Łódź. And then so we, and it's a long way, you know, and so I get there and I'd spend a few days with her just catching up or whatever. And one trip, 1 year, she said, look, you know about software. And I said, no, I know nothing. But she said, would you talk to my my nephew? Basically, she had a younger sister who had a little boy.
Okay.
Right. And the little boy was learning programming.
Okay.
And I'm like, you know, sure. I mean, I don't know, whatever, you know, happily, I'm happy to try and help. But so here comes this little kid and I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to do? He's, you know, what can I, you know, how do I not screw this up? Right. So he comes out and he tells me he's doing PHP and I'm like, oh. Already it's, you know, it's going poorly. You know, it's been 2 minutes. It's going poorly.
Bad.
Yeah. I don't know how to help, you know? And then he says, well, I'm learning Java. I'm like, oh, okay. 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 And then I said, well, how are you learning? And he comes out with a big copy of Thinking in Java by Bruce Eckel.
Wow.
And this book is like my favorite book, right? It's
how old was he?
He's, I don't know, 11, 12, 13.
Okay.
Somebody.
And he had a copy. Going through.
Yeah.
Thinking in Java.
But I had this book 20 years ago. And I loved it so much, I actually sent a letter to Bruce Eckel, the author. And so if you look at the second edition of the book, there's a letter from me in the book. It got printed.
Oh. Right?
So I love that book. And so I was like, oh.
Yeah, that was a good book.
This is a great book. And I was like, okay, never mind. This kid, I'm going to take care of him, right? If he needs anything, I'll get, you know, anything. So for years, I've had this, you know, just by email, right? This is... He's now 20, you know, he's older now and he's got a job and he's a programmer, this scholar.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah. He's smarter than I am. That's for sure. He's way smart. But so that's what I mean. I got and Roma, she unfortunately, you know, she passed away last year.
Oh.
But I still have, you know, and by the way, his name is Kuba as well. Jacob okay. as well, you know.
Jakob. But that's quite amazing that your mother managed to meet her while.
Yeah.
Bridge online in the 90s.
She and they didn't know it. She didn't have the chance to travel there.
Okay.
Right? So she didn't get a chance to travel to Poland. So they only knew each other online. They never met mm-hmm. in person, right? And so I met Roma in face to face years before she did. I took mom with me to Poland and to Russia in 2015.
Huh.
My mom's an older woman, and for her, as a child, you know, they taught us to hide under the table. You know, they taught Americans, if the Russians drop a bomb, a nuclear bomb, you get under the table.
I'm not sure that will help.
Of course not, yeah. Right? You'd die in a heartbeat, but it was just the propaganda of the time, you know? And so for her, as a child, going to Russia is kind of like... It's kind of like going to Syria or going to Cuba, you know, Cuba, like the island
mm-hmm,
nation.
Yeah.
For Americans, 40, 50 years ago, it was impossible. You would never mm-hmm. go to Russia, right? Now, of course, it's
now
open.
It's changed.
It's totally different, of course. And I've been there many times and I said, Mom, I'm going there. I'm going there this year and I'm going to Poland and your friend is there. I'll take you there. So we went together and we saw Roma and these little old ladies that have been friends online for almost 20 years, they finally met each other, you know, and then a few years later, that was the only time they ever met,
yeah.
right? But so that's what I mean. I have family kind of in Poland, but anyway, I still don't know how to pronounce anything. So,
yeah, I'm not sure if I'm even going to encourage you because it's not a useful skill, and
I think
it does take a very long time to learn.
I know the most important word. I know dziękuję, which is very useful because
that's
you know,
good. That means thank you.
Yeah, got to know that, and it makes sense that my friend, his name is Kuba, right? Jacob as well, right? So it makes sense that he would because he's Polish. It makes sense that he likes Skala, right? All the extra characters, right? You know, that's a joke. But anyway. So, okay, I'm glad I'm not the only one that doesn't have a clue, right? I'm not.
That's most of the people. I've even heard a podcast once where they mentioned my presentation
mm-hmm.
and they were like, okay, so her name's Olga and the second part of her surname is Sharma, but we are not going to try and pronounce the first part of her surname.
Well, at least they got that podcast was better than this one. I only got the first part. I got Olga. I didn't even bother with the last two parts. But okay, I didn't
keep trying.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep trying, and you know,
maybe next time.
I hope so. It's not out of disrespect. It's out of respect that I don't butcher it. You know.
Yeah, I imagine that, but I'm fine.
Yeah.
Like we anyway. Call each other first names here, and it's not a very formal atmosphere. So in the spring thing.
Well, plus you're the only Olga.
Yes.
Right. We have a few Michaels. We have a few.
Yeah.
Do we have a few Robs? No. Who else do we have duplicates of? Dave's.
Mark.
Mark. Yeah, we got a couple Marks. So, you know, it's fine. Exceptional in so many ways. Now, so you work on the spring team. You're on the spring cloud team, like you say. You're fairly new, it feels
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I joined a few in years? September.
Of what year?
Well, the past year.
Last year?
Yeah, the spring cloud team.
Oh, but it feels like you've been doing... I see your name in all these chat rooms doing all this stuff. You're always doing something. That's, wow, only a year.
I try to keep doing something. I try to learn and talk to people because there's a lot of new projects for me. So I like to talk on Slack and ask questions and gain some knowledge from the people that were maintaining the projects and the teammates that have been working on them for a long time. So wow. I am quite active on Slack.
Okay, now I understand. But as you say... it's not just questions I see you doing. I see Git commits that are making, you know, adding new features and fixing things and doing all sorts of stuff.
Sure.
And the reason that you're able to do that is because, as you say, before it was even called Spring Cloud Contract, before it was a separate project, a separate community project, what was it called then?
It was called Accurest. So Marcin and Marcin Grzesztak from the Spring Cloud team and Jakub Kubulinski, another colleague of ours, they started working on that tool. And I was probably its first user.
Yeah.
And I was working in testing back then. And I started using that tool, and around the same time I started switching to development, and then I've also started to contribute new. First I started reporting bugs, and then I started fixing some issues in the tool, and that's how I've stayed with the project. And over the years I didn't always have a lot of time to contribute to it, but I've committed some code and I've contributed some features. So yeah, it's a very near and dear framework to my heart because I've also done my first tech presentation on that. And yeah, and when I started to contributing to a very small library that two of my friends were developing, I could have never possibly imagined that it would end up in Spring Cloud.
Right. Well, I mean, it is not a small project now, is it? And so when you say you commit changes to it, first of all, it's got multiple languages in it, multiple JVM languages. You've got at least Groovy and Java.
Yeah, we have Groovy and Java.
It does some things that are pretty crazy. It has, you know, plugins that you have to work for Gradle and Maven.
Yeah, now it's extremely robust. Marcin has added a lot of features over the years. But back then when we were starting, it was a small library.
Yeah.
And I could have never thought I would end up joining Spring Cloud team as a result of having done some commits in that open source lib.
You made your own path, right? You did good work on that project, and so of course that would lead to you and Marcin and Mr. Kabrinsky, Jacob as well. There's three of them now we've talked about in this podcast.
Yeah.
Right.
For Jacob.
Yeah. You all three, you made this project successful. And so it was, I remember when we were talking.
And also other colleagues of ours, of course, contributed.
Lots of, and that's the thing, it was an open source project, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was really a community-driven project, open source. There were not a lot of resources behind it. It was just some free time and the willingness to start it and the idea that Marcin and Jakub had.
Mm-hmm.
And later on it has grown so much. We have started supporting so many features that now it's a really very robust framework.
Now when you... the project itself... From the spring team, I can tell you that when we brought it in to the spring team, we were talking about hiring Marcin, and we were wondering about, you know, just thinking about what that would look like in the future. It was very interesting. It was already a very vibrant community, you know, very, very vibrant community. And so we knew this would be very successful because it was already successful. There was no guesswork, right? We didn't have to wonder, is it a risk? It's not a risk. We can already see it's working. And then we knew that, that Marcin, of course, is, you know, he's very talented. So we knew that would be, if there were some issues, he would make it work, right?
Yeah, and he's extremely talented and also extremely hardworking.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You know,
he just doesn't stop.
Just a machine, a great machine, you know. And so he does this. And I know he knows good people. That's obviously, you know, how you came to us. When that project, has the project now gotten big enough that it's overwhelming for you? I mean, for me, for people, think about it. Think about how it looks for the Spring user. Most of the Spring projects, they start small and then they grow. But for this particular project, if you didn't know about Accurist, but you knew about Spring, suddenly there's this huge project. It's like, oh, we've got a new project. Oh, it's a brand new one, right? But no, it's actually been around like 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So for a lot of our users, I'm sure, and even for me, there's so many features in Spring Cloud Contract.
That's interesting. We keep talking about it in conferences and events, and still often we go and do a talk on it, and there's a lot of people coming to us telling us, wow, we really know Spring. We have used Spring Boot. We have used Spring Framework.
Yep.
We have used things from Spring Cloud, but we never really knew there was such project with such functionality. So I think it is becoming more and more popular, but it's still not in the Spring sort of mainstream. So there's still so many Spring users that don't even know that that project exists. So that's why we still keep going to a lot of events and we try to give talks about it regularly, because even though we've done many of them, there's still a lot of people coming that are completely new to this project, and we want to make it easy for them to join.
So first of all, anecdotally, just based on my personal sort of everyday experience, you know, I do this week in Spring, and so I put together content from the community, and I have seen over the last few years a lot of Spring Cloud Contract. It's a common thing. Every month at least I see something, and that's more than some of the other Spring projects. So
yeah, that's growing, and that's true, but it's still just recently. And we've been to Amsterdam with Spring One Tour, and we've done this talk, and there were so many questions, and people were really interested in it, and they were telling us that they didn't know it was there. So obviously we do have a very strong community, and the one thing that we're really happy about, we have a community that is very engaged. So they propose pull requests, they file issues, they do presentations, they write blogs.
Good
we
blogs
really
too,
have yeah. an awesome community. We have some community plugins that are very popular, so that's a great thing. But at the same time, we still feel that we need to keep talking about this project, because there's still quite a lot of Spring users that don't know
totally.
This project exists.
Yeah.
So.
And I did a talk on testing that includes that, right? And I know Mario.
Yeah, he's also been doing that.
Yeah.
Talk.
So there's, you know, we're all big fans of it. I think a lot of people in the Spring team are a big fan of that, and for a lot of our community, of course, when they hear about it, it's like, oh, you know, they didn't even know how to answer the question. They didn't know what they're talking about. So let's zoom back out, and we've defined what the solution is. It's Spring Cloud Contract. What's the problem, right?
Okay.
What does it solve? What does Spring Cloud Contract do?
Okay. So the problem is with testing your APIs and testing your communication in a way that doesn't require you to set up full-blown end-to-end tests. Imagine you have microservices, you have a robust ecosystem, and if you want to test everything in an end-to-end test, then you would have to set up these environments. It would be a mess. You could either have maybe one big environment and then have many pipelines use it, but that's no good, because if you run a lot of tests, people would be working on these different services, so the other teams would be restarting them, would be changing the config, and also you could sort of couple your deployment pipelines. So mm-hmm. even though you have separate microservices, their deployment is still stuck together by trying to reproduce it in a huge end-to-end test right. environment. And then you could have many different test environments, so one per pipeline, one per service in your deployment pipelines. But then you could have all the collaborators deployed there and working there. But that would be very costly, so both when it comes to infrastructure and when it comes to the maintenance. Mm-hmm. So we thought, as we are moving to microservices, like assuming we're starting with some kind of monolith where we could depend on end-to-end tests, now what we need to do is greatly reduce the number of end-to-end tests.
Right, because so they're slow, right?
You lose slow and fast feedback. They also like need the other collaborators to be up and running somehow, and that's complex. That's even complex with a monolith, but with microservice environment, that really becomes very tedious and often very difficult to maintain. So there are different approaches to that. There are companies that completely remove end-to-end tests, and there are companies that just reduce the number and just test their most crucial scenarios, the most crucial business cases.
But I
with
think
them.
As you know, in English, it's very common for people to welcome someone if you have a new job, right? It's very common mm-hmm. to welcome somebody to a new job, to say, welcome, here's your seat, right?
Yeah.
But it's considered, I think one of the more vulgar things that you can say in English to somebody that you're trying to make feel comfortable, one of the most vulgar things you can say is, here, deploy this Kubernetes cluster, right? It's very, very vulgar. It's very, nothing yeah. says, I don't want you here.
Okay.
Right? So you have to deploy this whole end-to-end system just to be able to develop on your local machine, right? That's a very bad situation.
Sure. Or you don't even do this and Oof. Just relay this test to some testing team.
Right.
So,
bad solution.
Yeah. So the point was, we sort of wanted to have a possibility to reduce the amount of end-to-end tests, but at the same time, we wanted to be sure that our integrations are working and our API communication is working. So we wanted to use stubs that are a popular solution.
Right.
Instead of running full-blown end-to-end tests, just use stubs.
So when you say a stub, when I think of a stub, I think of for example, a Mockito object, which is a mock is an empty object that returns null and false.
Sure.
A stub is something that returns pre-programmed results, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in the same way, we can use it on an API level. So there are various solutions. For example, for HTTP, you can use WireMock, which is an in-memory HTTP server, and you can define its behavior. So you can give him JSONs where you will define that if you get a request that matches this set of criteria, we want to get a response with this status and that body. So it sort of mocks out all the HTTP communications for you. Similarly with messaging, there are frameworks that will sort of stub route, so will allow you in your integration test to pretend that you are getting messages mm-hmm. Based on certain POJOs on various channels. They allow you to sort of simulate the situation. The problem with these frameworks is that even though they're super helpful for prototyping, when you use them to ensure that your communication's working, there is one main issue. The issue is that there is absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that the actual server behaves the way that your stub simulates.
Right.
So you have no way of knowing normally with the usual approach that your stub reflect the server.
And that's very dangerous too, because you feel confident because you've got a green test.
Yeah, that's a trap, because
right.
there's absolutely nothing other than, having talked to the member of the other team on the phone and them having told you that that's what the endpoint
right.
would be called.
Trust me. We'll figure
yeah.
out in production.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like, it's enough to change the field from ID to product ID mm-hmm. and the whole thing can stop working
right.
or just one can have a typo in the endpoint. Anything can happen. So you can use the stubs,
mm-hmm.
but you have absolutely no way of knowing that they reflect the actual API. Also, if you work in a company that has various services communicating with each other, people tend to change APIs sometimes.
Of course, because they're growing, right? Teams move fast.
And that might not be a good idea. In some companies, that's the way they work and they want to do it. Mm-hmm. But you will never know that they haven't changed something when you were not looking. So Spring Cloud Contract wants to sort of fill this gap and allow you to have stubs, but at the same time, ensure that these stubs really reflect the reality of your microservice ecosystem, of your communication, either over HTTP or with messaging.
Yeah. Now, for HTTP, the payload is the message of the HTTP request, right?
Mm-hmm.
So JSON.
Yeah, sure.
What other kinds of payloads can I send?
I have added the XML support.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I added it some time ago. And we took a long time getting to actually implement this feature because we do prefer JSONs and we think the world should slowly move away from XML. But at the same time, this was probably the most requested feature.
Really?
So, yeah, it was extremely popular. One of the most requested, maybe not exactly the top one, but it was a very popular feature request and a very upvoted issue on GitHub. So at some point, we decided that we just cannot wait for our users to leave XML. Then we just need to support them the way they are working.
So that's one of the first things you did on the team, or did you do that before you joined us?
No, I've done that after joining, and also after joining, I've added web test client support.
Oh, for the reactive stuff.
So I first had to, because we heavily rely on REST Assured.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for us not to have to change this implementation and sort of have it similar and in keeping with all the rest, I wanted to add a module, web test client support module, to REST Assured. So I've talked to the maintainer and he was happy to take in that change. So I've contributed that. And then based on that, just adding the web test client support for us was very easy. These were just few lines of code. Because, we did change a lot for that in REST Assured too, in order to support that.
So we should come back to that, because you just brought up a great point, which is that a lot of what you do is not just adding code, it's also working with other teams, and I'll bet you do that a lot. But let's come back to that in a minute. What other kinds of payloads? So first of all, we're describing payloads over HTTP, right? A payload is the agreed upon body between a producer and a consumer, right?
Yeah.
What other kind of payloads do we have?
We do support JSON, XML, and now also recently Martin has added binary support. Yeah, so it's in an effort to be able to support protobuf as well.
Okay, so maybe the RSocket stuff we're working on might figure into that as well?
We will want to have this, but I think we will first wait for support for testing from Spring Framework.
Sure, of course.
So once they're done working on that, we will be able to take this over and integrate it with Spring Cloud Contract.
Makes sense. Now, that's on the web side, on HTTP. What about on the messaging side? Like, is it the same basic? When you say a payload, why do I need a payload for messaging?
Usually, you just define the POJO and then use the underlying framework to serialize it for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. We can integrate with Spring Cloud Stream and Spring Cloud integration, Spring integration.
Yeah.
And we definitely support more options, but I cannot tell you out of the top of
my head. We used to support Camel and then it was gone for a little bit.
It was
back.
Gone, and then I think it's back because actually a user from the community has added it back. So it keeps changing. But
that's cool, and I love that. And then now these payloads, what Spring Cloud Contract does is it lets us be sure that both producer and consumer agree on what's going to be in a payload.
Yeah.
How do you define this agreement? How does Spring Cloud Contract let me define that?
So we write a contract and. Currently, there are two ways of writing it. So the first one is using a Spring Cloud Contract Groovy DSL.
Okay, love Groovy.
Yeah, me too. So I absolutely love the Groovy and I like the DSL. And it's super nice because if you use an IDE, it keeps suggesting you the method, so you can leverage the auto completion from the IDE,
right,
and the go suggestion. So you can do it in this DSL, or you can also do it in YAML. We do have
YAML.
Cool. Yeah, some people were requesting it. So we have introduced it.
I'm not sure if I'm going to use YAML. That sounds like
I avoid it.
Well, I mean, this white space kind of...
Yeah.
It's a little scary because I need a contract for my YAML file.
Yeah, but I also am not a big fan of using white spaces or syntax elements, but I think YAML is such a popular format that people were requesting it. And with Spring Cloud Contract, we try a lot to sort of see what our users need. Mm-hmm. And if we see that something is a popular request, even though we wouldn't like to go for it and we wouldn't use it if we were adding contracts to our production projects, we see that if so many people want XML or if so many people want YAML, we just add it. And
that's very pragmatic. I think that's the Spring in general. Yeah. Right? We try and just be as big a
make
tent.
Make it seamless for the users.
Yeah, because they're going to be stuck with these things, and we can't. If we can help them, why wouldn't we? You know.
So the other thing that we have in mind is we have an issue for Kotlin support.
Okay.
So we are planning to add Kotlin DSL as well.
Now, one thing I often hear about is, well, there's, you know, in the Ruby world, there's Pact, right? You've got this which is another consumer-driven contract testing CDCT technology. Can I use those? Can we interoperate with that?
Yeah, Spring Cloud Contract does integrate with Pact.
Oh, that's super cool.
So, absolutely, you can use it together.
Would we recommend using Pact? No, of course not. But
you can write contracts and then use the plugin and then actually transfer them to a format that Pact can understand. So it is is doable.
So you end up spending a lot of time, I imagine, in your work. I know you already know a lot, but it sounds like you're dealing with so much stuff that nobody could know everything. And so you spend a lot of time.
I just keep constantly learning. And to be honest, I also forget. Like, I can be working on something in 1 month and then work on something else and then go back to that topic after 2 months. So, of course, I need to refresh that and go through the API again. And even if you ask me things about Spring Cloud Contract, there are some parts that I have worked heavily on, so I can tell you everything, but there are some parts that I have not worked on. So I cannot even remember always all the methods and all the APIs that we have.
That's just Spring Cloud Contract. But I'm saying you have to do, in order to do your work, you have to not only know Spring Cloud Contract, which is huge and it's hard to remember everything, you also have to remember Pact and Kotlin and Groovy and XML and YAML and other projects.
Yeah,
right?
In Spring Cloud team, I also work on other projects. Even though I've done most of the big changes in Spring Cloud Contract because that's the project I know most, and I still do a lot of triaging and I fix bugs and add some enhancements in other projects like Spring Cloud Netflix or Spring Cloud Gateway or Spring Cloud OpenFane recently.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of different projects and I don't even aspire to like remember everything or just be able to tell you each class and each detail and each property, but I just try to learn on the go and talk to my teammates and also collaborate with the maintainers of other libraries that we use, that we provide integrations for. So I think that's just a part of my job. And I think that's what makes it interesting because there's not a day that I don't end up learning something new.
And working with somebody, right?
And working with somebody.
Because when we're on the Spring team, today, Stefan Nicole, he brought up a great point
the question session.
He talked about how Hibernate, how in order to serve our users, the Spring team had to reach out right after the introduction, after Java 9, 10, 11, after the JAXP module became, it was no longer included in the JDK. In order to make that situation better for our users, we had to make sure that Hibernate did the right thing. So now they include JAXP transitively in Hibernate 5.4, and that's now available for Spring Boot users. So it just works, right?
Yeah.
And you...
Yeah, we end up collaborating with a lot of great teams. Mm-hmm. So in Spring Cloud Contract, we definitely collaborate a lot with the REST Assured maintainers and committers. And then I know that Martin has been in contact with the WireMock team a lot. So then, of course, other Spring teams, that's obvious. Yeah. And that's awesome. We can collaborate with everyone. We also work with open fan maintainers. Mm-hmm. So just recently I've been communicating about some issues with Kevin Davies from open fan.
Right.
So that's a really great privilege and honor to be able to collaborate with so many great teams and great developers and learn from everyone.
I get dizzy just thinking about all the stuff that you have to do the work you're doing. Now that you've been on the team, you know, for a good while now, what are the things that you would, now that you feel comfortable, I'm sure you've already known Spring Cloud Contract, you're comfortable with that for years, right? But now you're also working with these other things. What are some of the things that you want to see sort of happen? What are the things you're looking forward to? What are the big, you know, what work do you see down the line that you're thinking, oh, I can't wait to get my hands on this and try it out?
Okay, so and we've been sort of changing our stack and adding new features and new possibilities to support reactive reactive paradigms. And just recently, Spencer from the Spring Cloud team, Spencer Gibb, has added RSocket support to the gateway repository. So that's really interesting. And I think the RSocket protocol has a really bright future. And then I think as the Netflix stack, the Spring Cloud Netflix stack is going slowly into maintenance following the decision on various Netflix projects that Netflix have moved into maintenance mode. We had to do the same with some Spring Cloud Netflix projects. So we end up developing our own solutions. And there's a new circuit breaker incubating tool, which I think is really interesting and provides a nice layer of abstraction. So Ryan Baxter has been working on that recently. And I think what we will also have to do is provide our own support when it comes to load balancing. So we will definitely have to discuss it at the team meeting. And I'm not sure what decisions will be taken, but I think we'll have some interesting work to do around that.
You were teaching me about the load balancer abstraction this afternoon. That was really very interesting. I can't wait to explore that more. You're like, that's really cool, you know.
When it comes to the web flags and our support for the reactive web stack in Spring, we now have our load balancer client annotations where you can pass the custom custom configuration for your Ribbon clients, for example. And we still use Ribbon underneath. So as Ribbon is also in maintenance, I think we will have to think of some other solutions, but I don't want to go much into detail because no decisions have been taken. And
you're also teaching me about the circuit breaker too. That was really interesting.
Yeah. So that's the new project that Ryan Baxter has worked on recently, and it has been added into our incubator.
Right.
And I really hope it's soon moved out of the incubator into the production-ready project. Because before, first of all, we had the Hystrix support, but Hystrix itself is now in maintenance mode, Spring Cloud Hystrix, and also Hystrix by Netflix. And now what we are going to have and provide is the circuit breaker abstraction. So first of all, it's an abstraction. And second of all, there's already a Resilience4j implementation, and Resilience4j is the suggested replacement for Hystrix.
So Resilience4j, that's a third-party project that solves a lot of common problems like circuit breaking and retries and
Well, it's same as with Netflix projects. What we want to do is take this third party project and provide a seamless integration for our users and the developers that make Spring Boot apps. So we don't want them to have to set up Resilience4j or whatever other tool on their own.
Right.
We just want to provide them with a starter where we auto-configure bins for them that they will be able to use very easily and just inject them in constructor and just make one method call or just add one bin, customizer bin in their configuration and adjust it to their needs. So
right.
We want them to be able to use these components but still maintaining this Spring programming style and leveraging the Spring Boot auto-configurations.
Wow.
So that's definitely something we want to continue providing. And even though the Spring Cloud, Netflix Hystrix projects will be in maintenance, we will be providing support to use it in with an abstraction layer
right,
and to leave Resilience4j up underneath.
So you can do both. You can have Hystrix today and then move to Resilience4j through the same abstraction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then you would only need to change the starter and then the tool-dependent configuration bits if you do any customizations. If you don't do any customization, you might as well just not need to change anything, just the starter, yeah.
So you're doing a talk about this kind of stuff, actually. You just helped describe one possible migration to a post.
Yeah, another thing we are suggesting is moving out away from the Hystrix dashboard and using Micrometer.
Yeah.
So I like this change, first of all, because it's necessary due to the maintenance mode, but secondly, because I don't really get why you would have your circuit breaker graphs and metrics in one tool and somewhere else and all your other metrics in a different aggregated in a different place, because obviously if you're running microservices, then you should invest in observability and you should have metrics also for other both technical and business features of your app. So
we had a John Schneider of Micrometer fame. We had him on the podcast as well. So is this using that?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really great if users can just use Micrometer for everything. I don't think there needs to be a separate dashboard just for circuit breaking.
So, what about the pretty visualization from the dashboard?
But there are dashboards.
There's other ways to do it, yeah.
Yeah, there are tools that allow you to do really awesome dashboards.
Right.
So I don't consider myself a dashboard master, but some of my colleagues create graphs in tools like Grafana that can use the Micrometer data through an aggregation tool like Prometheus. And they really look awesome, and you can see all these nice metrics and graphically displayed. And I know that the Hystrix dashboard looked nice, but still the possibility to have it all in one place and use one metrics tool for everything.
And then to use that to feed into other reporting is very powerful as well.
Yeah, and I think that's really useful. So I think that we should really just switch to that as soon as possible if anyone is still using Hystrix dashboard.
Makes sense. Are there other things that people should be aware of? I mean, we mentioned a few things. We mentioned the Hystrix circuit breaker and the dashboard.
Yeah, also Archives.
Oh, yeah,
Spring Cloud Netflix Archives. So I think that was probably not as popular to be used directly. It was rather used as a transitive dependency through other Spring Cloud projects. But if anyone is still directly using Spring Cloud Netflix Archives, then we would suggest moving to Spring Cloud Config Server.
Right. So Archives was the bridge to, it was a way that you could feed configuration from the Netflix style.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So probably the best thing to do is just move to Spring Cloud Config Server instead. And should work.
I don't think I've ever met anybody besides the people at Netflix who use Archives.
Yeah, so it's been used in our projects, like in the Spring Cloud Netflix projects.
Yeah.
As a dependency to integrate with their tools. But yeah, we don't even we are not even going to show it in our demo in tomorrow's presentation because we don't think that was really that popular among our users. But that's something that also should be changed if anyone still has it. And we also have work to do because some of our Spring Cloud projects, like various service discoveries, for example, like Spring Cloud Console, they still rely on, and they still have Ribbon as a dependency.
Right.
So there's a lot of work to do for us. And but I'm actually looking forward because I think that will be fun and that will be interesting to change it and to provide our own implementations for some of the functionalities and to collaborate with some other teams that are providing various tools. So
that is exciting.
Yeah, I definitely was a fan of this Spring Cloud Netflix stack and all that Netflix stack. And I remember a few years ago when I was just starting as a developer, maybe around 4 years ago or so.
Only 4 years. So you came from testing, by the way.
Yeah.
To me, that's much harder than development, right? Anybody can write code, but to fix it, that's way more difficult, right? Like,
but you wouldn't fix it.
You have to identify.
You find it.
Yeah. That means you have to understand it and then be able to see what's wrong with it, right? You have to understand what it should be doing. To me, that's a much more difficult skill.
You need to understand the business scenarios very well and the requirements very well and have the patience to collaborate with the business managers and then developers and discuss things, because often you end up being the only person that really knows exactly what is expected of that feature.
Oh, wow.
Depending, but not in some organizations, not like some of them work better, but you can still find a lot of companies working sort of a waterfall style, just providing you documentation, and the person that does the testing ends up being responsible for all the features being there and working properly.
That I think is, we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Because that to me is super interesting. I want to focus on that for a minute, but briefly.
Going back to the Netflix.
Well, you got Zool, that's Gateway. And you got to do load balancer
Of course,
support.
Sorry, I was so obvious for me that I ended up not saying it here, but Gateway is absolutely the replacement for Zool, and it can be used in production now.
That's already GA, and it's been good for a year.
Yeah, and Gateway is awesome because, so Zool was fine, and I really like that stack. Like when they created it, that was really groundbreaking, and we were really happy. I think everyone in most of the companies, whoever was doing microservices was using that tech stack. So they've done a lot of, they've really done a great job, but we have also moved forward.
Right.
And I understand that they want to now concentrate on developing their own platform and their own apps. And they actually trust us on the Spring team to provide them with ready solutions.
Right.
So I hope we'll still be in touch with them and gain a lot of knowledge from their production experience. But I'm happy that we get to work on replacements.
Yeah. They had that great blog last November, I think it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Where Netflix said we're doubling down on Spring Boot. It's the standard from for all of our stuff.
That happened, and it's really fun for us to be able to work on this, and also I hope collaborate with Netflix teams a lot.
Yeah.
And Gateway is obviously the replacement for Zool. So Zool allowed some setup and had some properties, but there was just a lot done implicitly, while in Gateway you end up setting up all your routes, and first of all you have various predicates that you can use to match the requests that should enter as a given route. But what I really like most is the filters, because the filters allow you to change virtually anything. So you can get a request and then modify it. So add headers, remove headers, change the body. You can do a lot of stuff with that.
Weight limiters.
Yeah, exactly. And you can also do retries.
Yeah.
And then you can get a response, and then you can still modify the response, even the response body, before sending it back. So I really think it's interesting. We have more than 20 filters now.
I wish people could see us. It's a podcast, so they can't really see us, but we're both smiling because this is super cool to us.
Yes.
And yet it sounds like it's a very simple thing, and yet nothing else does this, right?
I'm really happy I get to work on such great tools and contribute to them.
Well, all these things that you just described, all these pieces that we've just described, are super important, and they're going to be more and more important for people as they start coming more and more GA. And then not all of these are going to become GA at the same time, right? So, you know, the circuit breaker stuff might become GA first, and we obviously Gateway's already GA.
Yeah.
And then that's all very interesting. I think there is a smooth transition to a post Spring Cloud Netflix world.
Yeah, we will definitely not deprecate the projects until we are 100% sure that we have viable solutions that can be used in production, so our users don't really have to worry.
I can't wait to see what you and the team do, because, for example, when it comes to the load balancer stuff,
I wrote the first
foundational piece of the, I think Toshiaki has added to it since then, but there's the original Cloud Foundry Discovery Client implementation, right? And so I wrote one of these, and I had to figure out how to write a Discovery Client. And because we're using Ribbon, we have to manage all the Ribbon stuff. It's mind bending. I mean, I was able to keep in my head, you know, because you have to learn what everything's doing and then write the code, and then I got it out. It's like it worked, and I was like, okay, it all just disappeared. I couldn't keep it in my head, right? And it's very difficult because Ribbon is a very complicated piece of code.
Yeah, but it happens to me a lot. I just assume it's normal that if I have a break, I'm working on a certain project, because some teams, they just concentrate and they just work on one project. Well, we have so many projects. I just assume it's normal that if I haven't worked on a given project or a given part of that project, a module, for 2 months, I will have to just get it refreshed. Like, I will have to read that again. And probably we have some, each one of us has some projects or some modules that they continue working on heavily, and they know everything and they remember everything. And also some members of the team have created some of these projects from the start, so I expect they remember it much better. But since I'm quite new to the team, and in a lot of projects I just sort of jump in and try an issue, I see there's a bug, so I try to fix it. So I just think it's normal, and I assume I just have to go learning, and I enjoy it because also I have a very great team, and I can ask them questions, and they will always suggest me what I could do, or what they think about would be the better solution, or review my peers, and that's, we communicate.
They feel the same way, of course, right? The team is very impressed with you. I know that. Now, one of the things that makes you so good at this is, like you said, you've got this background in testing, which, like I said, I think that's harder. I think that's actually more difficult to skill to master than development, right? And
I don't think that it's technically less difficult. So it requires you to maybe have less actual knowledge, but it's very difficult as it requires you to communicate with a lot of people, and it requires you to be very persistent and to be very diligent. And I think it requires a lot of sort of not skills, but characteristics, like personal features. A feature is a software word, but I'm not sure how to tell this in English.
Qualities,
yeah, that's what I was looking for. So you need to really be able to communicate with a lot of people and make sure things are working as they should many times. So in this way, it is difficult.
Yeah.
Even though we probably have to learn less about tech to be able to do this, you might have to learn much more about your business. So it's a different level
I truly think that's more difficult, because you are learning. Also, you're acting as a detective, right? You're looking. Yeah. And so the question is, first of all, you have to learn what the business thinks it has and what it wants. Yeah. Then you have to learn what the software is supposed to do technically, because that's not always the same thing. And I'll bet you must get very, you must have things that you look for in a code base to help you put together this picture. I expect that tests are one of those things that you reach for. Now, is that one of the reasons you got so involved in Spring Cloud Contract, was trying to understand how to make tests more reasonable and reliable?
So when I worked with in the same place with Marcin and Jakub, we were as a company thinking about how to move away from that monolith and from those end-to-end tests and change it into some lighter and faster integration tests. And at some point, we as testers, we didn't feel confident about them just telling us to remove our end-to-end tests and giving us stubs instead, or asking us to write stubs instead, because we didn't feel that we could be sure in any possible way that the stubs really reflect what the other app does. So from that lack of guarantee, that need was born to have a framework that, okay, we will remove the end-to-end test and we will use stubs because it's not viable having them the way we had them in monoliths, and they were often slow and they were not efficient, and they would often repeat many steps just to differ at the last one. Yeah. And it was frustrating, but they gave us this feeling that we were sort of secure that the things work as we think they are, because there were so many calls being executed and so many features being tested. So we wanted to move in this direction away from these tests, but we still wanted to be sure that we are actually testing things. So not that we are defining an interaction and we are testing that our definition of an interaction is working.
Right.
So we wanted a way to be sure that it really works that way. And in Spring Cloud Contract, that's what the framework provides. So it will take a contract and it will produce two things. Yeah. It will produce, first of all, a stub that the consumers of the API can use to run their integration test against, but it will also generate tests to test that the producer's API actually works the way it's defined in the contract.
Right.
So that was the whole idea, to give this kind of assurance that everything works.
So what you're saying is you ended up doing this incredible engineering, like development work, in response to this perception about how the tests work, which goes back to my original point. I think being a tester is harder than being a developer. That sounds incredible. The fact that you were able to go from there.
To be honest, it was the developer team that ended up working on that and inventing the framework. But we, as the testing team, told that we wouldn't feel secure with just moving to stubs.
Of course, that's my point.
And when it comes to the architecture and the whole code and the implementation, that was, of course, the development team.
You solved an incredibly hard problem. That's so cool. When you go back into a code base and you're trying to figure out what it's doing, and you're trying to find you're testing, basically. First of all, you're trying to make sure that it does the happy path, and you're looking for the sort of the broken issues and whatever. How does that? Do you think there's a role for like manual testing in an organization today, or are you very much like focused on automated testing? Right. What is the difference there? When do you choose which?
First, as a disclaimer, I have to say that I've done quite a lot of manual testing. That's what I have started with. I started with that, and I liked working in IT and all of that. And then after starting, I went on to study computer science, and then only I gained the skills to move to something more intricate and more complex. And then, of course, I started automating and writing API tests, and then moved to development. So I've done a lot of manual testing, but to be honest, I think we should rely more on automation. Mm-hmm. We should do much more unit testing and much more integration tests and some end-to-end tests. And I still think there is a place for people doing manual tests, but I would see them It's something that Venkat Subramanian proposed actually during his presentation. So less just a person that would do manually what we could do automatically,
right,
but more of a person that would also have knowledge of usability,
right,
of business features, that could provide an input about the app itself and it's being or not useful to the users and improvements that could be done, and not just meeting certain criteria, because that is more
automatic.
Often than not, that's just an algorithm. Like,
right,
we feed you these numbers or this amount of money in a financial app,
right,
and we want to end up with that, yeah, amount after you do these
input
calculations.
Output.
So it's more, I think we could see the testers more also as the experts, so product experts and usability experts.
Product managers, that kind of person.
Yeah, or people that would think about the app in a more complex way,
okay,
than just carrying out the requirement test, also sort of generating these requirements. So I'm not sure that we would still have that much room for this traditional manual testing role.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a good thing to have. Now, question is, what does that look like in a continuous delivery world, right? We've got Spinnaker, we've got,
yeah,
Jenkins.
So we don't want to have a step in our pipeline when our pipeline stops,
right,
and there is a person going,
clicking around.
Yeah, we don't want that. So that's why I see that this role has changed, and probably we need much less testers and testers that will actually do different things, that they would really sort of test the app in production,
yeah,
and verify how user-friendly it is and how it matches the criteria that cannot be easily checked with a test like the usability. So I think it should go evolving there, because, yeah, I don't really think we should have a step in the middle where we put people. And it's just,
I've seen, for example, with Pivotal Tracker,
mm-hmm,
you know, we have Pivotal Tracker. People build some very complex workflows based on that. So you can use the API that Pivotal Tracker gives you.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody can, you can write a program that triggers a webhook. So when somebody, when the bug goes through, when you have a build, you can get the build to a certain percent or mm-hmm, a certain state, and you can have a call at the end of the build that goes into Pivotal Tracker, sets the ticket for that build,
uh-huh,
for the bug that you're working on that's related to that build. It sets the ticket to, like, ready for inspection, you know, basically. Or, you
okay.
know, you, and then basically now product management, it now shows up in their task queue,
uh-huh,
basically. And then they can click on the link. It's automatically added to the ticket.
Okay.
And it launches them into Cloud Foundry, right? Dumps them into the staging Cloud Foundry instance of the app. And there they click around. If they like it, they say accepted,
mm-hmm,
on the ticket. And then that triggers the final stage, which deploys to production.
Yeah.
Right? There's some, you know, so people do these kinds of things.
Obviously. But now also, I think a lot of other approaches are becoming popular, mm-hmm, such as canary deployment.
Yeah.
And I think it's better to sort of let you check how the users are going to react. Of course, if we're changing something which is critical,
right,
we will probably have someone verify it. But I also believe it's a role of the developers to verify that their code works. So write, of course, all the unit tests and the integration tests. But they should probably just make a demo code for themselves or
sure,
a pet project and just run it on their machine and check that it really works and integrates the way they expect before they push the code.
Mm-hmm.
But do we specifically need a team of people that should be a part of our deployment pipelines? I think that's making the process too slow.
Yeah.
And also, I think we are more and more moving from this approach where we thought that we could be fail-safe.
Right.
There was this mindset, like at some point people felt that if they do enough testing, manual testing, any possible kind of inspections, prepare loads of documents before, and then do a code freeze just to be 100% sure. There was this mindset some time ago, and then only release twice a year, not to mess things up.
Right.
That would be fail-safe, that we do all this and it will just work. There will be no bugs. So
no bugs.
We've learned as an industry that it never happens, that there are always bugs. There's research on it. So actually, even the best testing, according to all the best practices, mm-hmm. will always result in some bugs being overlooked. You just cannot see the 100% of them and test them away, all of them. So rather than wanting to be fail safe, mm-hmm. you could be safe to fail.
Oh.
So you could instead have the ability to withdraw your changes quickly. So you would have, first of all, you would do frequent releases. So you would know very fast what commit has created a bug in your code. You would test your PRs before you merge them automatically, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't be able to merge them before it's tested. But then also, as you build your app in your pipeline, you would have to ensure that it's backwards compatible. So it should be backwards compatible with the database. You shouldn't do like backwards incompatible changes in the database. So you can revert quickly if you see a bug.
Yeah.
And the same with the API. For example, if you use Spring Cloud Contract, you can actually add tests to your deployment pipelines to ensure that your API changes are backwards compatible.
Wow.
So you could use tests, contract generated tests, and have your new version of app tested against these steps and and then you could also rerun it with the older version and check if nothing has changed. So basically this way you become sort of safe to fail. So you accept that the reality of the universe and life is such that there will be bugs no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You're just ready and able to find them very quickly and to revert if needed, and then fix them quickly, and then push the fix very quickly. So deploy it really rapidly. So that's a change of a paradigm, but I feel that's the way we need to go, because we have learned already after many years of trials that it will never be bug free no matter
never.
What we do. Never.
It's in the job, right? If a debugger is something that helps you take away bugs, then what is it that we do?
Okay.
Anyway, my friend, I thought I knew some of this stuff, and I still learn
tons.
Don't
know. I keep going to your presentations, and I keep learning stuff.
Well, me too today. I mean, it's just crazy. You are in the middle of, it sounds like, all the interesting things that the stuff I'm following on the team, right, at Pivotal. All this cool stuff, right? Continuous delivery, testing, all the stuff that I think makes the difference between Spring Boot versus like the path to production, right? Software is just writing your app is the easy part, right? Getting it, because Spring Boot makes that easy. Taking it from getting an app.
Thanks to the enormous effort of the Spring Boot team. Yeah, we are also so happy that we can just use it, what they provide to us, and we can just put all these pieces together.
But I think the real challenge right now is, once you've got your Spring Boot app, how do I get from Spring Boot to production? From boot to production, right? And everything after that is testing, it's the platform, it's the continuous delivery pipeline, it's getting all of that stuff, right? And so
I think it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it's both related to providing these tools and frameworks, but also talking to people and sort of changing the mindset. Because in a lot of organizations, people are still reluctant, so they don't want to test if their, say, database changes are backwards compatible.
Right.
But they want to be able to make any kind of changes. But then if you really want to do frequent deployments, you have to work in a safer way.
Yeah.
So you need to adopt this. So it's both tools changes and developing new features and tools to make it work, but it's also sort of involving the communities to in a discussion on how we want to do it, how we want to deliver the software in a way that is safer, how we want to set up microservice ecosystems that are more resilient.
Right.
And that's interesting. about this for me.
And it sounds like you're in the middle of all of this. And
yeah,
so
that's why
I really
love being here. I'm really happy to be part of this team.
And I'm glad you're here too. We all are. And that's why I really appreciate your time today. I really appreciate it. I learned tons. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate your insight and wisdom as well. Where can they find you if they want to talk to you on the internet or on Twitter?
Okay, so definitely the entire Spring Cloud team. We interact with our users on Gitter.
Mm-hmm.
And
Gitter.
Yeah, the chat for GitHub.
Sure.
Yeah. So we are there, all of us. And also, I definitely have a Twitter handle, which is Olga_, and then goes my surname. So it's MacIazzek.
Zekzek.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to leave them with?
Well, try Spring Cloud Contract if you haven't already, and let us know what you think.
All right. Dziękuję. Thank you so much.
Dziękuję bardzo. Thanks.
A Beautiful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.